guest today on Newton Talks is filmmaker Charlie Steeds, who through his production company Dark Temple Motion Pictures has directed over 10 horror feature films since 2016, including Escape from Cannibal Farm, An English Haunting, Vampire Virus, and his most recent DVD release, Death Ranch. He joins me today to talk about his career development, his inspirations, and the challenges of very low budget feature film production. Charlie Steeds, thanks very much for agreeing to do this podcast. I'm going to start with a boring question. How did you get started in filmmaking and what inspired you to get motivated?
Like a lot of people, I've always just loved movies. Like I grew up loving just watching the telly. You know, it was really the one thing that kind of gripped my imagination like as a child. And then I guess I just sort of, through my teenage years, I just became more and more obsessed with finding a way to make the movies myself. And it's kind of, I guess it's lucky that the technology was kind of where it was at back when I was younger, because it may have been much more difficult, you know, if I was born in a different time. But nowadays it's sort of, the technology is so accessible. It's become, I think, really easy now to make movies. And I'm lucky I was sort of just at the cusp of that point where it was easy, you know. When I basically started making short films, when I got to like my fourth short film, and I would do like three a year, you know, I had an HD camera, so it was like, it wasn't all fuzzy and nasty looking. It looked quite slick already. And I had my parents had got me like an Apple MacBook, this was before anyone had like iPhones or anything like this. Like I'd never heard of Apple, but I think my mum was working for Apple. And so she was able to get me a MacBook, like a desktop MacBook. It had the iMovie software on it. And that kind of changed things a lot as well, at quite an early stage, because I'd made a short film and then I'd sort of given up on it. And then when I got the MacBook about a year or so later, I then had the ability to edit it. And had I not sort of had access to like iMovie and stuff like that, I might not have started. But aside from that, the technology side and just being in love with movies, I just made loads of short films. You know, I listened to what every filmmaker always says: if you want to do it, just go out and do it. It still is the best advice. And I'm lucky that as a 13 or 14 year old, I was wise enough to listen to that advice, because it is the only real best advice there is. So I did just get a camera, got my friends together, made 20 short films in total between ages sort of 14 to 20. And then having done 20 short films, I was like, well, let's try doing one that's feature length. Sold the feature length film to a sales agent, and then it got distribution. And I've basically just gone on from there.
So it's pretty clear, if anyone looks at your website or any of the trailers, that obviously you're massively into horror. I think you're wearing a City of the Living Dead t-shirt, I think, at the moment. People won't be able to see that on the podcast, obviously. So were these early short films, were they horror films as well, genre films, or were you testing different ideas out?
I was always interested in horror movies. I love all different types of movies. In my top 10 favorite films, which I wouldn't know off the top of my head, but there's not really any horror films in there. You know, I love stuff like Almost Famous, American Beauty, Donnie Darko. As a teenager, these are the films that really gripped my imagination and got me wanting to make films. Stuff like Thelma and Louise, you know, and Terminator 2, like quite a mix of all different genres. But for some reason or other, it's always horror that I've been drawn to creating. I don't think, like when I watch a film like Almost Famous and you get that sort of warm, fuzzy, nostalgic feeling, as a filmmaker, I watch that and I don't know how to create those feelings in an audience. Like, I'm not sure. It's something that would really challenge me. But when I watch a horror film and I see, you know, people screaming and carnage and stuff, I'm like, I know exactly how to do this. Which isn't to say that it's necessarily like an easy thing to do, because I think horror gets a lot of, you know, people sometimes say like, oh, you do horror because horror is easy, you know. But I don't think that's actually true. I think like horror is so much more difficult than just your basic drama. It might not be more difficult to get like sort of achieve it to be good. Like I said, it's probably really difficult to get a drama to actually be really like to make it really work for a viewer. Whereas horror, you know what you're working with. You know that, you know, blood and screaming equals scary, you know. But in terms of like the physical making of the movie, horror is really difficult, you know, and I've found myself over the last few years in so many like sort of horrible situations out in the freezing cold in the middle of the night, in all sorts of different locations and you know, all of that sort of thing. But yeah, for whatever reason, I was just drawn to horror, you know, and making horror. And that's what I still kind of, I just want to be like a horror filmmaker. You know, I'm loyal to that genre. I have heroes like Stephen King and John Carpenter and Wes Craven. And these types of people, you know, when you see Wes Craven or John Carpenter like deviate in their filmography from a horror film, I'm just not interested. It's like, you traitor, why are you doing this? Like, go back to doing The Thing and The Fog. Like, this is what you're good at. So I just focused on one thing to say, right, let's be good at this one thing. And that's what I'm basically on the journey of learning how to make good horror, you know.
You're obviously a British filmmaker. You're making low-budget British films. But your latest release is a film called Death Ranch, which is just available now on DVD and on Amazon Prime as well. And that was made in America.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I was always inspired by American horror movies, like the references I've just explained. It's like stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Nightmare on Elm Street. These are the films that, you know, I grew up on loving, and that's what got me interested in horror. I'd love to say, you know, oh, I grew up loving Hammer Horror and Amicus, and that's why I make British horror films now, but I never watched any of them, you know. They're not good enough actually to capture my imagination. I probably shouldn't say that as like a horror fan, but I've never actually seen a Hammer horror film that inspired me in the way of like Evil Dead 2 or Candyman or something like that. So when I started making horror movies, like feature films, my first one was Escape from Cannibal Farm, and the idea was to kind of, even though I'm in Britain, to try and make it as sort of American feeling as possible. I feel like that's naturally sort of where you kind of, I see it a lot, like filmmakers try and gravitate towards like, let's try and make it sort of American feeling or Hollywood feeling, because that's sort of what you're used to seeing and that's what you think is going to sort of sell. But actually, as I've made more horror films, I started to realize that what I've got here in Britain is really unique. Like, it's actually unique to the rest of the world to be able to go to, say, like a very British big country manor house and make like a haunted house movie. Nobody in America has access to those sort of gorgeous, very British locations. And so I've started to lean more into working with British things, because that's where I am and that's where I'm based. But then, so Death Ranch, the one that you bring up, I thought, well, I don't want to do the sort of quite amateur independent filmmaking thing of like pretending that a field in Wiltshire is, you know, Kentucky or something like that. And basically the opportunity came up to make this movie Death Ranch out in Tennessee, which was it was kind of just a sort of a freak event that a friend of mine who I'd been friends with over the internet, just another filmmaker, was, you know, extremely generous and just was saying, come over here, let's make a movie together, like come over to Tennessee. So the filmmaker is called Aaron Mertes, and he's made a whole bunch of movies, also horror movies and also low budget, over in America. And so he invited me out to Tennessee, and it's basically land owned by his family is where we shot the entire film. And I happened to have had a script laying around from a couple of years before, that I'd really wanted to do this sort of like blaxploitation inspired grindhouse style movie set in the 70s about these black characters having a sort of face off with the KKK and just making this sort of very like gory, splattery sort of black power revenge movie. It was something that I'd pitched to a lot of people, and companies always liked the idea, but they were like, we're never going to fund this, you know, black people fighting with the KKK. Like, it's sort of controversial in some ways. And the film itself, you know, just by the nature of the topic, it's full of sort of like scenes that are sort of edging on bad taste. And at the end of the day, it's grindhouse inspired, you know, it's exploitation. So that's the idea. I wanted people to watch the film and sort of be watching it thinking, is this okay to watch this? Is it okay for me to be enjoying watching this movie? Like, is it funny or is it just really bad taste? Like, I like how grindhouse movies sort of edge on that border. And so that's the only film I've been able to shoot in America entirely. And I'd love to go back and shoot more stuff over there, but I'm also very content these days to shoot British stuff.
So with Death Ranch, what was the production period like, the pre-production period? Were you conducting that transnationally over the internet, or was your partner doing it in America and you just went for the shooting? How long did you spend in America?
Yeah, it was, Death Ranch is a strange case because it was, what happened, it's a funny story. Basically, I'd finished making one film and I needed a job on another film. And this is what always, doesn't happen now, but for the first 2 or 3 years, the way it would be is I'd be editing a movie and you'd be getting towards the end of the edit and you'd be thinking, I need one of these companies to email me and ask for a new movie. Otherwise, when it gets to the end of the editing period, I'm going to have nothing to do and no job. And I might have to, you know, go back and get a day job or something. Like, I need, you know, there's always that panic moment. And anyway, luckily this company got in touch with me. I met them in a hotel for like 15 minutes and they said, we want this vampire film. And they told me the story, and sort of there and then it was agreed I was going to do this vampire film, which is my movie Vampire Virus. And I said, I'm free to shoot it now. Like, I'll get going right away. But my cinematographer that I sort of have frequently collaborated with was busy for a month. So suddenly I had a month free. So in that 3 month, I was thinking, well, what do I do? I've only got this month. I remembered my friend Aaron wanted me to go to Tennessee. I remember I had this script, Death Ranch, that was sort of ready to go. Or the script wasn't ready to go, actually. The idea was sort of ready to go. And there was also another company, Empire Studios, who'd been really wanting to collaborate, who I was now turning down because of the vampire movie. I was saying, I can't, there's no point us making anything. No thanks, I don't need your money. I'll go and do the vampire film. But I suddenly realized I had all these things in a month free. So it was a mad, mad rush to get Death Ranch made all of a sudden. It was something like I got in touch with Empire Studios and I was like, if you can get me the whole budget, you know, in the next sort of week or so, I'll leave in 2 weeks and I'll go out to Tennessee for a month. I wrote the script in 7 days, but it was something that had been in my head a long time. And then I was in Tennessee for a total of a month. The shoot itself was 15 days, which is the shortest shoot I've ever done. I usually do about 22 days as a minimum. And the most I've ever done has been about 26, 27 days, which is a lot for an independent film. Most of my friends who are independent filmmakers, they can shoot in like 10 days, 12 days. I have no idea how they do that. But for me and sort of the level of detail that I like to put into my films, I think 22 days is extremely quick. So 15 days in America was extremely quick. I cast it from Britain, but through like Skype auditions. And I was just really lucky with the project that when I got out there, I was literally the only person from Britain who was out there. And every single person who worked on the film, I was meeting for the first time in that month, including Aaron, even though I'd been friends with him online. I'd never actually met him in person. And I was lucky that every single person was just amazing to work with. And we were totally on the same wavelength. And everybody just put absolutely their all into Death Ranch, which has made Death Ranch kind of the most special film of like all my films. Sometimes a film, you're making it and it's like the film does not want to be made. That's most of the time, like you're battling. But in the case of Death Ranch, it was a breeze. Like the film wanted to be made and just sort of did it itself.
Did it help the fact that you were isolated a little bit? You had the person's land, you had commissions, there was nobody going to be, you know, coming across or asking you to get a location at a particular point, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and this is still a rule of any indie film, is location is the key thing to any film. All of my films are completely ruled by location. If Aaron had said, come over and make a movie in America, and he didn't have the ranch, let's say he just had an American house, a suburban house, it would have been a film set in a suburban house, but maybe I wouldn't have had a script for that, so maybe it wouldn't have happened. But I have always gone where locations are available, because that's the hardest thing, is just to get somewhere to actually make your film and not be interrupted. But we had many acres of land and this big barn and woods and an old sort of like dirt track road in America where most of the movie was filmed. So that was easy peasy. And certainly when it came to things like, we cut a tree in half and put it in the ground so it was gigantic and set it on fire and had a KKK, you know, filmed like a KKK cult meeting and sort of they're sacrificing this girl. So when we were filming that, that's something you could never have done in like in public land. It was freaky enough just being there in private, seeing it all happen. So that definitely helped.
I think as well, you were talking about the length of the amount of shooting days that you do in comparison with other filmmakers at about the same level or the same kind of budget level. One thing I've noticed when we look at those other films is they tend to rely, and this is a really broad generalization from what I've seen of them and from what I've seen of your work, a little bit more on dialogue, whereas yours are extremely action-based. Would you say that there's something along the, you know, it takes longer to shoot action, there's safety precautions you have to go through, the camera movements, the effects that you're using, that increases the amount of shooting days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Death Ranch is actually like an action-packed film. So to be able to do that in 15 days, there's a few ways we got around that, which was it's the only film I've ever shot with two cameras. It's mostly set in the daylight, which means you don't need to really do any lighting because you're in really sunny, hot, sunny, sweaty Tennessee. That was the look of the film. And so a lot of it, we used almost no lighting whatsoever. I wanted it to feel rough, handheld, documentary-like. You know, visual references were things like Devil's Rejects, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So that definitely was an advantage. The way I see a lot of, I mean, I'm really, really critical of my own movies as an independent filmmaker. I'm not sort of delusional and sit and watch them and think they're all great or anything. There's only three that I actually think are sort of what I'd class as watchable movies that I want people to go and watch and say, this is a good film, this because this works, you know, and that's 3 out of 10. But when I look at other people's indie films, I'm also critical. And what I see a lot of the time is, let's say the film was shot in 6 days, I basically see 6 dialogue scenes, you know, 6 long-winded dialogue scenes where people talk and talk and talk, and then it's done. And I can sort of understand it, because the way it works is a company will get in touch with me. They'll say to me something like, we want a film with werewolves inside a castle. You know, I made a film this year called Werewolf Castle, which was their title. And that was literally put werewolves in a castle and we'll be happy. Then you've got the budget and, you know, quality, it does matter, but, you know, also you're on a low budget, so there's only so much quality you can get. And to some people, what matters more than making a good film is, you know, just making a living, which is hard enough as it is as a filmmaker. So they would, you know, say, right, we got enough money for 6 shoot days, and so we'll write 6 really long dialogue scenes. And their emphasis is on sort of like doing the best they can within certain limitations. But my main love is actually writing, and I try to just forget all limitations when I go to write and make a movie. So when I wrote Death Ranch, I mean, Death Ranch very specifically actually was, I will allow myself 15 minutes at the start of the film to establish the characters. And then from that point on, I want them to be getting revenge on the KKK and it to be a bloodbath and full of action and violence. So I kind of don't really worry about the limitations, and for better or worse, that sort of, you know, my crew and cast, you know, they have to really go through it sometimes because we're just like covered in blood and jumping all over the place and smashing through walls and fighting and stuff like that. You want to make it, in my opinion, you want to make it as action-packed because you want the film to be entertaining, like above all else, above money or having a good time. That's the key for me, is to just put on a good show for the horror fans that are going to watch it, yeah.
And so, thinking about the script writing then, that's the thing you love most. Is that because you don't limit yourself to what I've got access to or one location? Maybe do you have a location in mind and think, well, I could set most of the film around this location, and after that you just build in the sequences, build in the scenes, and you don't think too much about how you're going to do it until you come to directing? Is that the kind of process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you just said, location is probably the one biggest limitation. So I can't really just sort of like write whatever I want, which is really annoying as a writer. You like, for example, I mean, I come up with some stories that I think could be really great horror movies. And, you know, there's a part of me that's like, God, I just would love to make this film right now. This could be like, you know, a really great horror film. But usually those ideas are the ones that aren't really achievable. And so you kind of have to just put those ideas on the back burner. And I spend a lot of time writing ideas that just I can't make at this particular moment. Death Ranch was one of them, because it was America and, you know, all these KKK and stuff, and I'm here in England. I put that on the back burner thinking I'll never be able to make this until I'm sort of much bigger and I can get more money. And, you know, suddenly that one was able to go ahead. But it often is the location that allows for a film to suddenly happen. I made a film called An English Haunting, which is like a haunted house movie. And that was literally because I came across this house. I was doing some corporate video work there and I made friends with the owners. And I just knew that this is a haunted house and I need to make a ghost story to fit in this haunted house. When you then get right in the ghost story, that's knowing that the haunted house is what you've got, that's really your only limitation. So in that film, you know, we set fire to one of the bedrooms and the film sort of ends with this blazing fire in the house and things like that. They're ambitious and they don't look as incredible as they would if it was like a Hollywood budget. But there's always a way around it. So we actually had to reconstruct just one wall of the bedroom and the bed in someone's garden where we could then set the bed on fire. And in the film, the shots, they just match up perfectly. In fact, when we were in the garden burning the bed, you'd look through the camera and it just looked like, it was weird. It looked like we were back in the house, you know, and then with a bit of smoke and lights and stuff like that, you know, flickering orange light, you can sort of pull off something that resembles like a fire. So there's always ways around stuff like that. But aside from that, I would never think of like having low budgets as limiting my writing. I would try my best to avoid that. Just write anything, you know, windows smashing, things getting set on fire, whatever it is you need. There's always like a creative way around it.
So does the length of time you spend on a script depend on when you need the film to be made? Or do you sometimes take a hell of a long time if you've got a particular project that you want to gestate? or is it sometimes you need to write the script in 3 days because you're shooting it in 7 days time? Does it vary?
Yeah. These days, these days my schedule is just like, it's so full. Like basically at the moment, companies are trying to ask me to make more movies than I possibly could make within the space of a year. And so I try to do as many as possible. And that can often mean that like, you don't have enough time to actually work on the script. So in the case of like Death Ranch, I knew I had maximum 7 days to write the whole script. And so that was like a mad rush. I used to prefer to write things over a longer period of time. So like 3 or 4 months would be a good amount of time to slowly write a script. And then it feels like the ideas are just coming to you much more organically. You can add more detail. But then, in fact, when I watched back my first two horror films, they were both almost 2 hours long in their runtime. And actually what I learned was I'm putting weight, like if I have all these months to just, you know, indulge in my writing, actually I'm putting far too much into it, you know. What we're making is low budget, straight to DVD horror. You should be able to write it in a week, you know, actually you should, if like without rushing, because it should just be a simple idea, straight to the point and get it done. And I'm definitely not one of those people. I get emails almost every week from people sending me their scripts. And so many of them say, you know, I've been writing this for the past 3 years or whatever. And I've never been that type of a person. Where it would take me that long. I believe in like just get it out on the page and get it done. Anything you're kind of holding back is kind of a fantasy, because it doesn't take 3 years to just write out an 80-page script or whatever. It takes a week or 2 weeks if you like. And nowadays, I actually prefer writing where I can go, where I can say, right, I've blocked out 10 days. This is going to be 10 days of writing. And then I just go at it hardcore for those 10 days. I prefer that now rather than saying I'm going to do 2 hours every evening, which is how I used to write, was to just add a little bit more every day. Now I love to just absorb myself in the whole thing, because then I go to bed and I'm sleeping and I'm thinking of ideas in my sleep. And then I'm in the shower and I'm thinking of ideas. I like it to just consume me for that period. But yeah, all in all, I think probably two weeks or maybe 3 weeks is enough time to write a script. And that's about as much time as I get now with my schedule and stuff.
So that's the script writing. What about when a company approaches you and says, we want werewolves in a castle, but how do you summon up the castle at that point? How do you go about getting a castle within that space of time?
That is where things can get more tricky. Like I said, you really want to write around a location. And so I go to production companies all the time and I say, I have this fantastic location. Look at the pictures. It's free for me to get access to this place. We should make a film around here. This happened recently. I've got access to this amazing cave. So I'm pitching to this company, let's do a cave movie and we can have aliens running around in the cave. And, you know, one of my favorite films is Aliens. So I was like, there's Marines, there's aliens. And then they decided, well, aliens should be in space, so why don't we do it on a spaceship? And I'm kind of like, you don't get it. I don't have a spaceship, you know, and I'm not going to be able to find one. I have a cave, so that's why we need to do it in the cave. So the project never happened because, you know, they couldn't quite get their heads around that. So then in a case where someone comes to me and says, you know, we want a film set in a castle with werewolves, before I say yes to it, I will then go and write to castles and find out, can I actually get access to the castle? How much would the castle cost? And what I actually agreed to earlier this year was to do two films that were both set partially in a castle. And so I went and got 5 days of filming blocked out in two castles in Wales. And when I knew the price of that, then I could go ahead to, with the production company and say, yeah, I've got the castles. Let's progress. But still, that was two whole movie budgets for only 5 days in the castles. So the castles were a really ambitious location, the most expensive location I've ever shot at before. But, you know, if I could have got them to agree to, you know, werewolves in a cave, which I have the cave, then I would have saved thousands of pounds in the movie and we could have had more shoot days and all this sort of stuff. But so in that case, you just have to go sort of where... to what sells, you know, the company knows that it's the castle that's going to sell it, you know. So in that case, I was lucky enough to be able to find one, but it's not always the case.
So talking about money then, I don't expect you to divulge the exact amount that you spent on these films. What kind of budget levels are we talking about? Give me an overview of your career so far in terms of where you started to what you're working with now. Does it vary, or is it an upward trajectory, or is it up and down?
Yeah, well, this is what I can say about that. When I first came out of film school, I'd made all these short films. The most expensive one of my 20 short films was a £1,500 short film. And then the cheapest one, the cheapest one would have been like a tenner probably. But in fact, I made one just before or kind of at the same time as that £1,500 film for £300. And actually, when I looked at the two films, the £300 one somehow was slicker. And so really from that point on, I've known that actually it's not really budget. It's not the level of budget that's important. It's more like what you're trying to do and how you're spending it and stuff. But when I came out of film school, I needed to, I didn't know, you know, it's coming out of film school was horrible because this industry, you cannot get a start in this industry. There's people say, oh, you know, if you know the right person or, you know, maybe apply to just go and make cups of tea on the set in Pinewood or whatever. But I've always known, like, I want to write movies and direct movies. I don't want to make tea. And I don't want to be a runner. And no, I'm not going to spend 10 years like working my way up a ladder. And in fact, I've read in a lot of like big director interviews, you know, people like Ridley Scott and stuff like that. They've said stuff like, you know, this myth of the ladder, it doesn't actually exist. I mean, I wouldn't know because I've not tried it, but I've read that people just say, you don't work up the ladder. You know, if you're a director, you're a director. You know, and so that's basically was my mindset coming out of film school. I'm not going to get some lowdown job. I'm a director. So I saved up some money and I spent a total of, it was less than £2,000 to make my first feature film, which the idea was, it's just a short film, but it's just going to be longer this time. We're just going to literally keep doing what I keep doing, but just make it feature length. And everybody said to me, well, that's not how it works. You can make your short films. And by the way, my short films were usually like half an hour long, sometimes like 45 minutes. So they weren't very short films. I was always interested in like longer movies. And people were saying to me, like, it's impossible. You can't make a feature film for £2,000. But because I knew I could make a 45 minute short film, I knew I could. And it kind of, I would just thought, well, I'm just going to do it. I'll just try. And so the film, the movie is called Labyrinthia. It also has another title in America, Dead Man Apocalypse. It's not a horror movie. It's more like a post-apocalyptic fantasy. And it's just, like I said, the budget's £2,000. It's extremely, extremely low budget movie, almost to the point of like the whole film's quite ridiculous, really. It's like so DIY. I just went ahead and did that, and that was the best thing for me to do, really, at that particular point, because then I got the movie. Basically a company from LA just got in touch with me out of the blue. They wanted the movie, they wanted to distribute it, and it's gone on to make lots of money, and it's made me back money. So that's how it started. I then self-funded exactly the same way for the next couple of movies. Again, with the budgets were bigger than $2,000, but it was as much money as I could like save in a year working my job. And then came a point where companies were saying, we'll give you money to make stuff, which was amazing because I've been putting all my savings into making a film. And now someone's not only going to just pay for the film, they're also going to pay me to make the film. So it was kind of the reverse all of a sudden. Now I'm actually like earning money from the films. And from basically that point on, I was able to quit my day job. It was obviously difficult for the first year or two. But by basically my one rule has been every single film I do, make sure the budget is more than last time. So sometimes that's an increase of, it's never less than say $5,000. Usually it's more like $10,000, but keep jumping up. So by 10 films down the line, the budgets have gotten much, much higher to a point where they're still peanuts in Hollywood terms. We're not talking over $100,000 or anything like that. But it's absolutely enough money to one, pay me a full-time living and also pay all my actors and all that sort of stuff. So I think people obsess over budget and what is possible at certain budget levels, but unless you're a producer with spreadsheets in front of you breaking down the costs of everything, the budget really is irrelevant and should be completely irrelevant. You know, if I was to say, you know, I made a $2,000 film at the beginning, you know, most people would just switch off. They don't want to know about it. They know that the film's garbage. But I'd argue that, you know, not necessarily. You shouldn't be obsessed over numbers, because when you're sat there watching the films, you're never going to see the producer's spreadsheet. So you have no idea. Even if I told you the film was, you know, £1 million, well, you don't know how to break down £1 million if you even tried. So just shut up and watch the film is what I say to all those people. But you want to make the film look as good as possible. So you always want to try and get the budget up. Yeah.
And I think those films that you're talking about and the level that you're working at, they're appealing to genre fans who are used to films of that level, I would like to think. But also there's something about those very low budget films, the $2,000 films, the $5,000 films, where what you're looking for is not for it to be perfect or completely perfect in every way, but for things that are either inspiring or that bit is particularly interesting. I watched, it's called, your other title's called Dead Man Apocalypse, I think, Labyrinthia. I think that was the American title. So I watched that the other day. And what I liked about it, it reminded me of the film, the Canadian film, science fiction film Cube, where I think they just had one set and they lit it differently. Well, you've got this kind of underground tunnels, and I wondered, was it just a short stretch of tunnel that you constructed and you lit it differently each time? Or was it a very big, long set? For people don't know, the whole film set underground in these like wooden slatted tunnels.
That's right. Cube was like, when I was younger and I watched Cube, it was a huge influence. Because like you say, they just had one cube, one room. The whole film is set in one room. You know, I meet a lot of directors who are trying to get their start in indie films, and they're trying to come up with sort of shortcuts around how can they not have to, you know, go out and do the full thing, like shooting all over the place. How could they just do it like maybe just two characters talking over the table or something like that, and that's the whole film. But Cube is the ultimate film for... Cube does not feel like a film set in one room. It feels like a film set all over the place. And it's a really great film. But so that was totally the idea that I took into Dead Man Apocalypse, was we built one tunnel and the whole film essentially is set in kind of this one tunnel. I mean, the whole film is shot in a cow shed. I mean, Dead Man Apocalypse is not a very good example of sort of what I'm trying to say about, you know, budget can be actually irrelevant, and people should really, especially filmmakers trying to break in, they should broaden their mind about how much money you actually need. Dead Man Apocalypse is like the worst example because it's, I don't think it's a good movie, and it's definitely DIY, and it's definitely like, I mean, when I say I made 10 films, I don't class that as one. I class it as like a sort of a stepping stone movie.
I didn't mean to embarrass you.
No, funnily enough, I end up talking about it on podcasts all the time because when it comes to like, I'm always trying to sort of explain my movies. Really, I'm always trying to reach out to other aspiring filmmakers and creatives who could sort of like, learn a few things from what I've done over the past sort of few years. But yeah, Dead Man Apocalypse is not the best example, but something like Cube, I do believe now, today, you could make Cube for like 10 grand, you know, and I think it would look just like Cube. It wouldn't, you know, I do think for even 10 grand, you can achieve so much with a movie. And there's so many people, my point is just there's so many people who will turn their nose up at it, but Cube could easily be done with modern technology at that budget level.
Do you work with, when you're on set, how much do you plan out your shooting beforehand? Do you work with a storyboard or is it a vague shot list? How closely do you work with a cinematographer? I think you shot some of the films yourself.
Yeah, over in recent years, I've basically now stopped working with the cinematographer and started doing my own cinematography. Basically because what I'm paying a cinematographer, I realize I could actually, instead of paying a cinematographer, I could actually pay for more shoot days. And with more shoot days, I suddenly have, you know, so many more hours free that I can take things a little bit more slowly. I can do the lighting myself. It kind of came around by accident. The vampire film that I was talking about earlier, my cinematographer was busy for the month, so I had to go and do Death Ranch. And then when I came back from Death Ranch, he was still busy and still trying to sort of put me on hold. And he's the only cinematographer I was sort of willing to collaborate with. He's the only sort of indie level cinematographer that I look at and I actually would like to collaborate with. And so because he was busy, I just thought, I'll just do it. I'm just going to do it myself because I can't wait around forever. And I'd just done Death Ranch myself, which was a purposeful thing because, like I said, I wanted like that gritty documentary style. But actually, when it came to doing some of the night shoots on Death Ranch, there was a lot of lighting involved. And I was really surprised how much lighting was involved. And then I was surprised at how happy I was with my own lighting. And then I realized really how much of the cinematography, even though I'm not the one rigging the lights, how much I was kind of determining as a director. And then I basically realized that I'm kind of lighting it anyway. It's just now I need the extra time just to put up the lights. And so I started doing cinematography myself now. When I can, when I have time, I try my best to plan the film as much as I can. I've never done storyboards because I just think my focus has always been try and just sort of fine tune my skills at walking onto a, you know, walking into a room and saying, right, this is the scene that has to be shot today. And, you know, how am I going to achieve it? Like you want to fine tune your ability to right then and there on the spot, know the best way to do it. And I'm pretty confident in my ability to do that now. So even if I had no shot list or anything, and I just walked into a set to film this particular scene, nowadays I feel confident that actually I'll be able to come up with something on the spot that will be pretty much perfect for what I wanted from the scene. But ideally, before I shoot, I'll go through the whole script. And I'll make notes on every scene about, you know, any little detail I want, and specifically the shots. You know, I definitely want to have a shot list of shot ideas that I've got. And I definitely want to have visited every location and just sort of wandered around to see, like, where am I going to put people, or at least looked at pictures. So, yeah, ideally I show up and I've got a shot list. If it's a scene, hopefully there's maximum like five shots. I try and keep it as simple as I possibly can. because simple always looks sort of slicker and better. It's always a case of like, how few shots can I tell the scene in? So if it's two shots, that's even better. That's basically the level of preparation I do. But there are some days where you get on set and you've not even looked at this particular part of the script for 2 months, and you just have to wing it. But it kind of all turns out fine in the end, you know?
So what's it like working with, what's your strategy for working with actors? Do you have much time to rehearse? Do you need them just to say their lines? How was it when you went over to Death Ranch to working with American actors in comparison with British actors?
Yeah, basically my technique when it comes to actors is, like, as a director, my general rule is I love the script. Like, I would try not to direct anything if I wasn't in love with the script. And so I get to any project, I'm in love with the script, I'm in love with the characters. Usually I've written it myself, so that helps, because obviously I do enjoy it. And when I speak to the actors and cast the actors, so much of it actually comes down to casting. Like, when you're sat watching self-tapes, or if they're coming into the room for a live audition, basically what you get, like, as soon as they open your mouth, you know in 10 seconds if they're right or if they're wrong. And what you get then and there tends to be, this is what you're going to get, you know? So if you make the right choices when it comes to actually the initial casting, the initial 10 seconds when you first see them, then the rest will sort of work for itself, because you've already cast the right person. Like, they've walked in the room and they just are your character. But knowing if they're right or not comes down to if you actually really love your script. If you're sat there, if you're looking through loads of different actors and you're not sure which one it works for you, I'd maybe suggest that maybe you're not quite in love enough with that character, because for me it's like, I definitely know exactly what I'm looking for, and then when they appear, I just know almost instantly. Like, it really does take like 10 seconds. So if you've cast someone who's good and fits the bill already, then that's a good thing, and that's going to help you a lot. And then from there, it's just a case of, in terms of my directing style, get to know, like, try and get friendly with the actor. I always just, like, I'll always meet up and just go for a friendly coffee and just generally talk through the script. Really, you want to make sure they understand the script and they understand what film you're making. And if their thoughts are sort of a little bit different from yours, you know, you basically want to make sure you both fully know exactly what this script is and sort of the whole idea behind it. Most of the time, I mean, one thing I always get with my scripts is actors always say, well, the script's quite self-explanatory. You know, we know that this guy is horrifically evil, or we know that, you know, it's kind of there in the script. So they'll say it's explanatory. So from there, you just want to make sure they're comfortable, make sure you're friendly with them, and like, have a fun time on set. I'm like, working with me is so zero pressure, because what everyone will say about me is like, I'm so chill and relaxed on set that like, you don't kind of even know if I'm asleep or awake. Like, people have described me as that before, because I'm just so, so chill. But I just want everyone to have fun. Like, and this kind of comes from my days of making 20 short films as a teenager. We were doing it for fun, you know, nobody was being paid. The only reason my other teenage friends were out in the woods getting covered in blood in the cold was because they enjoyed it and they had fun doing it. So I've always felt like the more fun you have making something, the better the end result turns out to be. When you've got a difficult actor, things do then become a little bit more complicated, and it does happen. For me, one thing I always get is, because I'm young, especially with older actors, they'll come on set and they see the way I do things. Like I said, very chilled out, very relaxed. I have a minimal crew. Like, I work with a tiny, tiny crew. Usually there's like 3 of us. That's the way I've preferred working. I mean, for every film, I've cut crew down and down and down to be as few people as possible. And that's another thing that I think some people have a misconception, that they think, you know, a crew of three people could not possibly make a good movie. But again, I think that's a complete misconception, especially with current technology. And I was watching a documentary about Stanley Kubrick the other day, and they were explaining how towards the end of his career, he was working with few and few people. And they were describing the set of Eyes Wide Shut, which is one of my favorite films, and saying that, you know, they had like seven people in the crew, and that if you walked past, you wouldn't have even known there was a film being made. And so I was really surprised, because I was like, wow, you think of Stanley Kubrick as like technical excellence, like film at its absolute finest. So that's my new go-to thing now, is when, especially like an older actor, if they say, you know, such a tiny crew, and they, you know, they just assume I don't know what I'm doing. You know, to be able to just point out, you know, Stanley Kubrick only had, you know, seven people in the crew. You don't need all these people. But that goes a long way with what I was saying about having a low pressure environment for the actors. That's partially one of the main reasons I have so few people. I mean, the biggest reason would be a financial thing. You know, you save a lot of money by not having loads of crew around. But a huge advantage is it does tend to feel like just me and the actor on the set. And that's why the actors are so relaxed on my shoots. And then I tend to befriend actors a lot of the time as well. They go on to become like close friends of mine. But I'm always hearing stuff like, working on your films just feels so different to any other film because it's so relaxed with you. And because I'm relaxed, I can do my best work. But I think probably actors like that's my focus on set, is how can we make the whole day be about the actor getting the best performance, you know, and just having fun. You know, it's quite an unusual sort of mindset to bring to a day of filming, which can usually be quite intense.
So when you're on set then, because you're doing a lot yourself, you've got a very small crew, but you've also got a lot of action. How do you ensure on-set safety and the stunts and the effects? And how do you go about making sure that that's all done and that's effective as well? Not just that it's safe, but also that it looks great.
Yeah, most of the time, the things I'm doing on set, because, yeah, I agree, like you say, action is one of the things that gives me the biggest buzz as a filmmaker. Like as a teenager, I watched like the sword fight in Kill Bill, and that's the reason I want to make films, and especially like violent movies, is because I'd watch that and that's what blows my mind. And the other thing that blows my mind is really long monologues. You know, like we mentioned Eyes Wide Shut, there's some really lengthy monologues. When someone can just command the screen for a straight 5 minutes, that's the other thing that gives me a buzz. But anyway, to answer your question about safety on set, all the action I do is usually through sort of very like basic camera trickery. So no one's ever really in any sort of a danger. You know, when it can look really brutal, but because it's like all edited in a particular way, nothing we're doing is even remotely dangerous most of the time. I did get to a point where, this was only on my third horror film, I realized I need to have foam weapons. So instead of real weapons, they should be made of foam. So in my first film, Escape from Cannibal Farm, people are swinging around a real chainsaw. And naturally I found the biggest, rustiest, most evil looking chainsaw I could find. And that's a real chainsaw being swung around. I mean, no one was hurt, but that was kind of through luck. They could easily have been hurt. But then when it got to my film, The Barge People, that's my third horror movie, everything's made out of foam. So it can look really vicious. And sometimes, yeah, people will get an axe in the face and it does hurt for a few minutes, but it's a foam axe. And it's no different from like play fighting, like when you were a kid. So on the one hand, there's all of those types of things that you can do. And it is my absolute worst fear that someone would get hurt on my set. That's what I will lay in bed before a shoot, you know, during the days before the shoot. I'm laying in bed awake and I'm thinking, oh, that scene with, you know, that machete, what if it goes wrong? What if they, you know, so partly my own paranoia like ends up preventing me from doing things that are too dangerous. And then on the other hand, sometimes there is just, it is just a case of like, screw it, let's just, if we want this film to look good, guys, let's just wing it and do this dangerous thing. But that doesn't ever tend to be with actors that, like, I would never do that with an actor that I've only just met and I'm working with for the first time. But a lot of my actors that I use regularly, we've become really close friends. So for example, I've had lots of like fire on set in my recent films, and some of these fires have got really quite outrageously huge. And no, there's no fire safety person or anything like that. Obviously, yes, I recommend anyone making a film that they should, but you kind of, you know, you watch back on the special features of like stuff like The Evil Dead or all those types of movies, and people in the indie film scene, sometimes you do just wing it, you know, and you are just lucky to, you know, you take a risk, but you make sure it's nothing too crazy, you know. But for me, it's mainly just been a case of like having lots of fire on set. That's probably the most dangerous thing I do, but we have buckets of water around and we've been lucky enough that fire has not spread or like burned the whole place down yet.
So just back to, I've got a couple of questions yet before we close up. So when it comes to generating profits and audiences, where do you find you get most of your audience, most of the returns on the money come from? Is it from Amazon Prime? Is it from video on demand? Is it from DVD, international sales? Where are you finding most of your returns come from?
It tends to be from digital, which for me is that I'm a huge DVD fan. Like, I love physical media. I love to collect things and see things on DVD. It is digital where most of the money is being made. And a lot of, in fact, I'm working with companies now who will say to me, there's no money in DVD. It's just going to be released to digital. But in terms of like where they're making their cash, for me as a filmmaker, basically I do see royalties from my movies, but what I've started to do, what I started to realize quite quickly, because the royalties, you know, some films can be a big hit and some films can see nothing and just stay in the minuses. So I basically realized when I get offered a budget, from that budget, I need to take a payment for myself that is enough that if that's the only money I ever saw from the movie, then I'm happy. So that's what I do. So for me as a filmmaker, I take on the job, I take my fee from the budget, and I'm done. I'm not interested in any way really in money and how much money it makes from that point on, you know, which is like when someone comes to you and says, you know, we want this film idea, Werewolf Castle, it's like, well, it's not my idea. I'll agree to make it and I'll do the absolute best job I can. But I take my fee and then I'm kind of done. And if the film makes no money, I'm not going to be very bothered. And if the film makes loads of money, equally, I probably won't be very bothered because I won't see that much of it. But I'm content with the money that I've actually got. But I know from seeing reports and stuff that it's digital sales. It tends to be stuff like in America, they'll say to you stuff like, if we can get a sale with Redbox, you know, that's going to be great. This is like a rental service they have over there in their supermarkets and stuff. So then if you see on your sales report, like a Redbox took a certain amount of units of your movie, then you know you've made a good chunk of extra cash from Redbox. But it tends to be like on the report, you see VOD, and that's where the most money is, whether that's Amazon Prime or whatever, because I'm like a DVD person, I don't even know what some of these streaming sites are. I look at them all, Hulu and Peacock and all this sort of stuff, and I don't even know what it is, or Tubi. You know, everyone, Americans always write to me and say, your films, it's free to watch on Tubi. And I don't even know what that is. So I'm glad they've watched it. But and something they've started doing recently is putting the whole film on YouTube, which, to be totally honest, I got no clue really how they're making their money through just putting it on YouTube, but like my vampire film has over 5 million views on YouTube. And because of that, the company who funded it are very happy, got in touch with me. They funded my next movie for like double the price of what I made the vampire film for. So some money is being made somewhere down the line. But I don't know how they make money on YouTube. I guess it's like advertisement and stuff like that. But yeah, digital basically is where it's all at.
So you've got, I looked on your IMDb. I haven't got it up on my screen at the moment, but you've got several films that are in development, shooting, in post-production. Mm-hmm. And what's next? What's coming out next? Death Ranch came out just very recently, didn't it, on DVD?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. In the UK, Death Ranch came out this October. And I think Death Ranch might be the only film of mine to actually come out on DVD this year, which kind of makes it look like I've had a quiet year, but it's been absolutely hectic since like the pandemic. The demand for independent film has just gone through the roof in a way that I've not experienced in the last few years of filmmaking. So I've shot 3 movies this year. One of them, which is now finished, is the first one of the 3 to be completed, is this film Werewolf Castle. So that'll be out on DVD early next year. The other one is a film called The Bloody Tower, which is like a ghost story set in the Tower of London. Also a sort of medieval movie, also filmed at the castles. That one I'm editing at the moment, so that will be out on DVD again sometime next year. Then there's a science fiction film, which is the first time I've ever done science fiction. And it's like, in terms of its special effects and stuff, it's like way more ambitious than anything I've ever done. And that's called Gods of the Deep. And that is also in post-production, and that'll be out next year as well. And then just oddly enough, like I made a film called Winter Skin a few years ago, and that is finally coming out to DVD in the UK just randomly. So that'll be out as well. And then I still have my film, The Barge People, that's due to come out here. So that'll be out potentially. I mean, it has a distributor. But for me, I mean, sometimes it can seem like I'm doing so many films and people are like, how have you got this amount of films all coming out on DVD in such a short space of time? For example, during the first lockdown, it seemed to be like 2 or 3 years of work all suddenly came out on DVD at the same time, which was a bit bizarre. But to me, I try just to make 2 films a year. I try and space them out as evenly as possible as I can. I dedicate as much time to each film as I possibly can. It's a lot of films, but I never rush them. And so, yeah, it's basically 2 films a year, with each film taking roughly 6 or 7 months. And then sometimes I can't even keep track of what's coming on DVD and where and when. Usually I'm not even the first one to know. Someone will message me and say, I've pre-ordered your film and I didn't even know it was coming out, you know, in a particular country. So I can't keep up with it really. But for me, my focus is just keep making the movies and having fun. And like, kind of behind me is this trail of films coming out, making money, doing this, doing that. I try just to keep my eye on moving forward and making new stuff, you know, and that seems to be working for me.
That was Charlie Steed. His latest film, Death Ranch, is now available on DVD and Amazon Prime. I've put a link to Charlie's company, Dark Temple Motion Pictures, in the description. Thanks to Charlie for joining me today, and thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.